Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Cassopolis, Michigan, in a farmhouse with no running water. The son of a one-armed handyman, he put himself through college by washing dishes and earned his law degree at night while teaching handicapped kids in Detroit's public schools. He was mayor of Detroit for 8 years and then became the first African-American president of the American Bar Association. His name, Dennis Archer. We're honored to have him as our guest. I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now, back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
Our guest tonight is Dennis Archer, chairman of Dickinson Wright, the third largest law firm in the city. Dennis, welcome. It's an honor.
Jack, it's my privilege to be with you.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
I was born in the city of Detroit. Age of five, we moved to Cassopolis, Michigan. My dad lost his arm just above his left elbow before I was born in a car accident. He had a third grade education. My mother had a high school education. Cassopolis had a population of about 1,500 people. It's a rural area. It's a village as opposed to a city. I ultimately graduated from Cassopolis High School in the largest graduation class ever of 79. We had an undefeated basketball season. We lost in a regional to Kalamazoo Christians. We're a Class C school. Played golf on the high school varsity team. And grew up with an appreciation for values. I learned how to say yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, yes, sir, no, sir. Learned as was the vernacular then. My colors and my numbers before I started school. And there was not a parent-teacher conference that my mother was not at that she didn't go to. And I better have something on the bulletin board that had a gold star or a platinum star or something up there. Otherwise, I heard about it before we got home. And I'd also say I grew up in an environment while we didn't have a telephone. Somehow, my parents heard about whatever might have occurred at school before I got home, and the teachers were always right. So I grew up in Cassopolis and acquired, I think, a good set of values. I appreciated the fact that in order to have something, that you've got to work for it. My dad worked for a gentleman by the name of Fern Westcott, who owned a tool and die shop in South Bend, Indiana. Mr. Westcott had his winter home in Sarasota, Florida, and he had his summer home on Diamond Lake in Cassopolis. Interestingly enough, Diamond Lake, a beautiful lake, very clear, very clean. Those of us of color could not swim in Diamond Lake. And despite the fact that my dad worked for Mr. Westcott on Diamond Lake, I couldn't swim in that lake. They chased us out of that lake more times than I care to imagine. And we grew up, or I grew up, I was the only child. They couldn't afford to have anybody else, I guess, but me. But in any event, we grew up, or I grew up, which would be today considered below poverty. In our home, well, we did not have running water. Thus, we had an outhouse, which meant if it was 90 degrees or 40 below wind chill factor, if you needed to go to the bathroom, you went to the outhouse. We had a well that we pumped for drinking water. And I took a bath in a tub every Saturday night. But while we did not have a lot, my mother and father always instilled in me that if you don't have it, work for it, save your money until you're able to buy it. But most importantly, they said, if you want to get beyond where you are, the best thing you can do for yourself is get an education. you are going to go to college. Neither one of them had ever been to college. They couldn't tell me what I should major in or anything like that. But I understood clearly when I was growing up, I was going to college. That was the fundamental kind of, oh, I'd say the beginning of a work ethic, value, and appreciation for education that's carried through for all of my life.
Your work ethic, you started early. At age 8, you were caddying. And setting pins.
Park Shore Golf Course at age 8 and earned money. Also, my dad had a little garden out behind our house. Between our house was a garden and a railroad tracks. But in any event, my dad showed me how to plant and to harvest our vegetables. And we had raspberries, red raspberries, and I would sell that on the side. And then during the wintertime, I set pins in a bowling alley. Now you go to a bowling alley, everything is automatic. Back then, those guys, they come in for their bowling league and fire that ball down, and the pins go flying all over. We're ducking everywhere. If we had to set pins, we'd have double lanes. But we earn money.
So, you got a BS in education from Western Michigan.
Yes.
Then you taught disabled children in two Detroit Public Schools.
Yes.
1970, you got a law degree from the Detroit College of Law.
Yes.
So you went into law. Talk about the field of law, the calling of law.
In my own view, Jack, the practice of law is a calling to public service. And you see so many outstanding men and women who are judges, who serve in our legislature, who do all kinds of things. And if you think about what lawyers have done in this world in terms of William Fulbright and Abraham Lincoln, and when you think about Gandhi and Franklin Delano Roosevelt as president and Thurgood Marshall as a lawyer who argued 32 cases before the United States Supreme Court and won 29 of them, the most important of which I think everybody would agree would be Brown versus the Board of Education, that the United States Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, and a court led by Chief Justice Earl Warren, declared that separate but equal public education for students was no longer constitutional.
When we come back, can we talk about what drove you to decide to run for mayor? I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Dennis Archer, the former president of the American Bar Association. Dennis, you're doing very well as a Supreme Court justice. I think in 1992 or so, the lawyers voted and named you the best judge.
That was in 1990, Jack.
All right. And why did you decide to run for office?
Well, first of all, please appreciate the fact that I never envisioned when I was growing up in Cassopolis or going to finishing up at Western Michigan University to begin to teach. I never envisioned myself being an elected official. And after having run a number of campaigns for people, and as I was finishing up the presidency of the State Bar of Michigan, I was very fortunate to be the first person of color to be president of the State Bar of Michigan, as when I was president between 1984 and 85. About that time, Mr. Justice James Ryan of the Michigan Supreme Court was elevated to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and there was a vacancy. I received a telephone call and asked if they could advance my name to Governor James Blanchard to fill that vacancy. I thought they were kidding, but I said okay, and it turned out that Governor Blanchard did appoint me to the Michigan Supreme Court, and I really enjoyed public service. I enjoyed the privilege of being one of seven on our state's highest court. When you consider that almost 98% of Michigan's legal issues are solved in the Michigan Supreme Court or in the court system, and they do not go beyond the Michigan Supreme Court, that's a very awesome responsibility. But at the same time, Jack, I was reading the newspapers about how kids at that time were killing and injuring each other over jackets and gym shoes. We were losing businesses by the droves in the city. And several people came to me and said, why don't you run for mayor? I said, I'm on the Supreme Court. I enjoy what I'm doing. I said, you ought to think about it. And an election passed, and then all of a sudden things continue, not all of a sudden, but things continued not to progress well for the city. So I began to think about what I might be able to do. Here I'm serving about 9.3 million people as a member of the Michigan Supreme Court. But I thought that if, perchance, I could make the case for becoming mayor, that I would have a better chance to be a public servant to help just over a million people, but the impact of the city actually affects the entire state of Michigan. So I resigned from the Michigan Supreme Court. I think it was April that year, the Michigan Lawyers Weekly did a survey among lawyers and judges of their readership looking for the 20 most respected judges in the state of Michigan, and I wound up being number one, which was a lot of pride that carried me for a long way, and I still feel the same way about that today. And that is, when I finally took a look at all the issues and had a lot of help of people causing us to focus on solutions to the problems that we had in the city of Detroit, we wrote a document, and one of the guys that helped me a great deal was Al Lucarelli. Al Lucarelli at the time was a managing partner of Ernst & Young, Nettie C. Brooks, who was at General Motors, Michael Frank, who was then executive director of the State Bar of Michigan. These are all folks that were around me, working with me, helping me craft what we knew could be some solutions to the problems we were facing in the city of Detroit. I produced this document. We published it, put it out in the public domain in November of 91. November of 92, I offered myself as a candidate for the office of mayor. Maury Gleischer, God rest his soul, was very helpful in helping me to identify a premier political consultant, David Axelrod, who helped me begin to fashion in graphic form what should be said, how it should be done, how it should be put out on brochures. And as we looked at television, I brought in Sue Marks, who had won an Emmy for the State Bar of Michigan when I was president, to do some other kind of things, to talk about what lawyers did. I think the title of it was No Law Without Lawyers. And we were off and running. I walked the streets. I shook hands. I answered questions. We had town hall meetings and the like. And I just really felt that if I were privileged to have the opportunity to run for mayor and be elected, that I could make some changes in the city of Detroit. And fortunately for me, the citizens gave me that opportunity.
You've done amazing things. You've been a pioneer over and over and over. Where did you get the courage, the guts, one, to even dream those things, and two, to have the persistence, the work ethic to make them happen?
Well, I will tell you, my mother and father, despite their lack of formal education, always made me believe that I could do almost anything as long as I got a good education. My grandmother, my uncles, I had three uncles, Uncle Jimmy, Uncle Ronnie, and Uncle Warren. They had a very, very important influence on my life. And my aunt, my mother's sister, Josephine, was just outstanding. And I was really blessed to be married. My wife, Trudy, has been a tremendous influence in my life and helped shape a lot of things that I've been able to do. And when we had our two sons, Dennis and Vincent, they were very, very supportive of the sacrifices that I needed to make in order to offer myself as a candidate. And my wife and my two sons bore the brunt of a lot of unnecessary and, quite frankly, inaccurate information that occurs in the life of a public official. And so I credit my family, but I also have a very strong religious belief. I don't wear it on my sleeve, and I will read the Bible in a New York heartbeat to look for solutions to what I might be going through at the time. And so you can call it good support systems from Trudy's parents, Eleanor and Jim Duncan. Her sister has just been a godsend for me, Beth. Beth has been my finance guru when I was running for Supreme Court, when I ran for mayor. And I've just been very fortunate to have very bright people around me throughout everything that I've done.
What qualities do you think are essential for a person or a leader to achieve success in public service?
I think you have to have integrity, character. You have to put people first. You make decisions on what will benefit those that you want to serve rather than what will cause you to be elected or reelected. Putting people first. If you do right by people, if you cast your bread on the water, it will come back to you.
We're talking to Dennis Archer. I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Crisula.
Welcome back. We're with Dennis Archer, former mayor of Detroit. Dennis, what do you believe are your biggest achievements in the 8 years you ran the city?
Jack, I leave it to historians to list what they think my achievements might have been. I will just simply say to you that I was very delighted and felt very privileged to have the ability to work with so many fine men and women who live in our city. The men and women are, you can't find another city anywhere in America, in my view, that offers the volunteerism that we do. We change Devil's Night into Angel's Night. For example, stop the fires from burning and cause it to be a positive kind of three-day event. When we clean up the city of Detroit under Operation Clean Sweep, first year we had about 17,000 people who volunteered on a Saturday to clean up our parks and around schools and the like. And then the last year I was in office, we had about 50,000 people who came out to do Clean Sweep. I mean, that's from the community. From the business community, we never could have achieved the empowerment zone, the thousands of outstanding jobs that were created, the $20.2 billion of new investment that came in the city. The 1990 census had the city of Detroit having the largest percentage of population who live below poverty, 32.2%. And when you factored that out, 46.6% of our children live below poverty, and 35% of us who are age eligible could not afford to own a car. The 2000 census had 15 other cities who had a higher percentage of people living below poverty. We really created a lot of good jobs in the city. So I thank the business community and our suburban community, our elected officials that really helped unite this region to make it great.
How do you explain year after year the Jerry Lewis Telethon were always one or two? There's more charities, there's more charitable giving. Why?
People have a big heart who live in this city. They understand and they're very sensitive to the needs of others, and they will do that despite their own personal needs. That's what's so great about this Detroit region and about the city of Detroit.
When we come back, let's talk about the future of this city, Southeast Michigan, and the state of Michigan. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're with Dennis Archer, who I believe now carries a handicap of 6.
Oh, no. My handicap's me and my clubs. I'm listed at the golf club at having a 17, but I'm playing more like to a 22.
You've talked a couple times today or tonight about education.
Yes.
Our parents could make a good living with their hands and their back. Arguably, you and I could have for decades. Going forward, that's gone. Can you talk about education?
Jack, what we know today is that at least even during our times, interestingly enough, if you think back to our times, we reflect by and large and we're influenced by our parents. Typically, our parents, wherever they worked, if they worked for a city or state or federal government, or if they work for the automotive industry, or if they work for the financial institutions, etc., they had a lifetime employment. They'd never changed jobs. You and I, our peers, we started changing jobs every so often so that we changed jobs 7 or 8 times during our work career. If you talk to a futurist, Jack, a futurist looking out into the future will tell you that education is the absolute key to the future, because the manner in which we will be gainfully employed will be based upon the quality of our education. We will be employed to work on a project, Jack, for a company. We'll work perhaps 6-7 years, maybe tops, but when that job is over, we then go someplace else. So we are not tied to a particular employer as we or our parents were, clearly, and as you and I might have been during our period of work years, but we'd still switch between 7 or 8 times. The young people coming behind you and I, Jack, are going to be changing jobs all of the time. They're not going to be locked in. Businesses are not going to be putting themselves in a position, as we found the steel companies, as we find the automotive big three today, with the legacy issues dealing with pension, dealing with health care costs, etc. When you work on projects, you're like an independent contractor. You're going to be responsible for your own health care and your own pension, your 401ks, etc. It's going to be a different ballgame, Jack.
In today's world, we have to keep earning while we're learning.
Absolutely.
We never graduate in today's world. Charter schools, Detroit public schools. What's the right mix?
I think personally that charter schools have their place. But in my own view, I believe that charter schools should be chartered by the Detroit public schools. And why I say that is, Jack, the public school system everywhere in America is mandated, federally mandated, to provide education for all of our children irrespective of the challenges that they may have. Well, in my last year in office, Rick Reardon, who was mayor of Los Angeles, Tony Williams from Washington, D.C., and Dick Daley of Chicago, we went down to make our case to Secretary Page, who was the Secretary of Education during the first administration of current President Bush. We met with leaders on both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats in the House and the Senate. We wanted to make the case that the federal government was underfunding public education. Rick Reardon said for one of his students in a learning disabled class, they were spending upwards of $125,000 per child. So that when you and I read in the newspaper that in, say, Bloomfield Hills or in Detroit or in Livonia or Escanaba, where they're paying out or they're receiving, say, $6,500 per student, you assume that that's what's being spent on each child. That's not true, because when you factor in what must be spent for those students who have learning disabilities, then you appreciate the fact that that's not the $6,500 spent on each child. So when you take money away from the public schools and you give it off to charter schools, you hurt public education. You hurt those who are mandated to be serviced by our public schools. Now, if you authorize charter schools to meet the needs of the workforce of our companies and the like, if you want to make sure that our young people graduating from high school don't go into remedial classes in colleges and universities, then I believe charter schools have their place. And if you charter them through the public schools, you're able to educate our young people, focus their attention on the narrow area of which the charter school has been created, and you don't hurt the other young people in public education. I believe in public education. It has its place. It is absolutely needed. Jack, if we don't do anything about public education and properly fund it, China right now is focusing a lot of energy, a lot of priority, a lot of their dollars on educating their young people. Now, you shouldn't be surprised by the numbers. In the United States, we've got almost 294,000 people. In China, they've got 1.3 billion people. They're graduating 300,000 engineers every year. In the United States, for example, 65,000. Guess who wins? And when you consider the needs and the infrastructure needs that they have in China, China is going to be demanding a lot. Right now, oil is being concerned. I mean, there's a big concern. China needs more oil. Steel, China, with all of their building, their infrastructure needs, they're got a corner on the market of steel versus here in the United States. What's the point? The point is simply this. If we don't start educating our young people, if we don't have an education president like President John F. Kennedy did for NASA and said we're going to put the first person on the moon and fund it and have a massive work effort toward that, if we don't do that for education, the United States, at the end of the day, probably by the year, it's what the futurists say, 2010, 2012, China's going to be the number one economic country in the world, United States number two or three. That's what I think about education.
3 weeks ago, the world focused on this city because of the All-Star Week. That Sunday, legends, etc. Monday, the Home Run Derby, Bobby Abreu, Pudge, fabulous. Tuesday's game. As you sat there in Comerica Park, looked across the street to the Fox Theater, down the street to CompuWare's building, Campus Martius, the GM logo on top of that Rensen, the Ford Field, those were all things you brought. What were your thoughts?
First, I wanted to thank every weatherman and woman that, starting with WJR and every other station and TV station, for giving us outstanding weather. Then I thought to all the volunteers who made the city look great. I thought about Mike Illich and the hard work that the Illich family has done to cause Comerica Park, and as I look down to Ford Field, thinking about what the Ford family has done in terms of, I'm talking about William Clay Ford Jr. and Sr., in terms of bringing Ford Field to the city of Detroit, and the Super Bowl is coming up. we've got a fascinating future to build upon. And thinking about Ford Field just for a moment, next year, Jack, in 2006, we're going to have $1 billion 30 days between the International Auto Show and the Super Bowl 2006. Then coming right behind that, we're going to have the regionals for the basketball, NCAA basketball. We're going to have the Final Four. We got the ice with the Final Four coming with the college high school. The college hockey games. I mean, we've got a lot to build upon, and that this city has a bright future. But we're going to have to have some changes as well.
Now I know how Marianne Mahaffey feels when you get excited over here, okay? How do we can't just let this be a spike.
It won't be a spike.
Jack. How do we keep building on this?
Take a look at what Roger Penske's done as the captain of the team. When I asked him to take on the responsibility to bring us home the Super Bowl, which we did in 2000, and when the NFL made it happen, Roger Penske went out there and raised $14 million, then had to raise another $4 million to make sure that this Super Bowl will come off exquisitely in 2006. We will build off of it, Jack. We've got a great community, business community, community leaders, the whole nine yards. We've got a great suburban city relationship that we can build upon. This region's going to be strong. This whole state's going to be strong. We've got some good leaders that will make it happen.
When we come back, we'll talk about you becoming the first African-American president of the American Bar Association. We're with Dennis Archer. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Dennis Archer. Dennis, in 2003, 60 years after the American Bar Associated lifted the bar against African Americans, you became the first black African American president of the American Bar Association. Can you talk about that?
Well, it was a very special moment in my life. When I graduated from law school in 1970, I had a professor, Donald Campbell, who at Detroit College of Law said, you know, I know, Dennis, that you're going to be just like your other colleagues who are graduating, and you, as a general rule, will clearly gravitate to the Black Bar, in this case, the Wolverine Bar Association, which is an affiliate of the National Bar. And he said, you know, but I urge you and encourage you to get involved in the mainstream bar. So I took his advice to heart, and it was helped almost immediately by a person who would later become one of my best friends, and ultimately we became law partners. I'm speaking of John Kersel. John Kersel was a lawyer in Dickinson Wright. He reached out to me almost after I passed the bar and said, we need you to get involved in the Detroit Bar Association Young Lawyers section. Then he said, we need you to get involved in the State Bar of Michigan Young Lawyers section. Then we need you to get involved in the American Bar Association. I went to my first ABA meeting in 1972. I'd been to the National Bar Association meeting the year before, and that same year, 1972, and you leave an annual meeting where you see African-American lawyers from all over the United States, great continuing legal education classes, etc. And then I went to my first ABA meeting out in San Francisco. And at the Young Lawyers section meeting, the lawyers from all over the United States, there were only two African-American lawyers, only two people of color at that meeting. One was a Army person who was there to recruit for the JAG Corps and myself. I made a conscious decision. The decision was I could either stand on the outside and condemn the American Bar Association for excluding African Americans as members excluding us and even changing the membership application so that you had to list your ethnicity. And if they didn't recognize your name and know you to be white, they would have a lawyer belonging to the American Bar come to the law firm to make sure that the person who was applying was not a person of color. And that changed in 1943. The first person of color joined in 1948. And I think about the Thurgood Marshalls and the Damon Keys and the Otis Smiths and the Wade McCrees and the Geraldine Bledsoe Fords and so many others in our home state, for example, who could have just changed America if they had been involved in the great debates of the American Bar Association on the issue of race, on the issue of civil rights and the like, but they were not permitted as members. And so I considered myself very fortunate to know all of these giants and to be able to stand on their shoulders. And so I decided I would work from within as a throwing bricks. And so I worked within to make a lot of changes. And the thing that I was most proud of, Jack, was not that I became the first person of color in the 127-year history of the American Bar. The thing that I was most proud of was coming right behind me as president-elect was another African-American lawyer by the name of Robert Gray from Richmond, Virginia. And when I was in last year, the American Bar Association elected its first Cuban-American to be chair of our House of Delegates, which is our policymaking body, Stephen Zak. And then they elected Armando Lasso Ferrer, a Puerto Rican, as our secretary-elect. So the American Bar Association has changed. My message to all young people, irrespective of color, is that we need to really appreciate the rich diversity that we have in America. In our own community, for example, in the metropolitan area of Detroit, we have 141 different languages spoken. So it becomes real important that we appreciate the diversity that we have, because the world, Jack, we live in, we talk about global marketplace, global competition. We've got almost 294 million people living in the United States, of which just over 30% of us are of color. But guess what? China's got 1.3 billion. India's just over a billion. Pakistan is just under a billion. Then you've got the continent of Africa. Then you've got the countries of Japan, Philippines, etc. My point is simply this: the world in which you and I live in right now today is majority people of color. We need to get beyond this issue of race, manage it, respect it, appreciate what people of color have given and contributed to world American civilization. We'll be miles ahead.
Recently, you gave an interview and you talked about the browning of America.
Yes.
And you said that people of color by the year 2056 will be the majority of people living in the United States.
That's a true statement, and it's based upon what the demographers and the social scientists were predicting in 1982 and 83. They based that, Jack, on birth rate and the relaxation of immigration rules. In 2003, the Census Department said the Latino population at 13.2% was the largest single ethnic minority group, followed by African Americans at 12.7. Last year, the Census Department said that the Latino and Asian population is going to triple in size by the year 2050, and that in 2050, the non-white Latino population will be 50.1%. The demographers and social scientists, I believe, may be off by a year or two because I think the majority of people living in the United States will be before 2056. So diversity becomes very important in our hiring practices. Jack, if you're selling cars, if you're selling fast food, if you're selling clothes, you need to be able to make sure that you earn a market share of the people who have discretionary dollars in which to spend. So it becomes important in terms of our hires. If we begin to hire and have a diverse employee base, guess what? When we go to do business in China and India and Japan, or we want to do business with them or do business over there, it helps us to have a diverse understanding within our own workforce so that we know how to be real competitive and to appreciate the culture, traditions, etc., in other countries in which we do business.
We have tremendous issues in this state. There's a lack of energy, positive attitude. What are the keys to making this state vibrant and great again?
Jack, I disagree with your predicate. There's a lot of energy in this state. There's a lot of pent-up frustration. People really want our state to come back, and we will. I think, for example, Jennifer Granholm has been doing an outstanding job. Our businesses have had some setbacks, to be sure. We got legacy issues that they got to deal with, health, pension, etc. We've got to make sure that we solve those problems. But it's not just in the state of Michigan. It's got to be solved on a federal basis as well. I predict to you, Jack, that the state of Michigan is going to come back. It's going to come back strong. We're going to grow. We have our ups and downs. If you take a look at history of America, you take a look at the history of Michigan and the state of Michigan, we have our ups and downs. We're coming back, and we're going to be stronger.
If you were in a room with the union leaders and Dieter, Bill Ford, Rick Wagner, what would you tell them about these legacy issues? What's the solution?
Jack, I wouldn't tell them anything, but what I would say is, look, it is abundantly clear if you take a look at what has happened to the steel industry with the bankruptcies and the steel and a number of the outstanding steel companies that were great before, made a lot of profit, hired a lot of people. They've had to get rid of, they've gone into bankruptcy. They no longer have pension plans. The employees no longer have health plans. We need to find a solution now to make sure that in our outstanding unions, these men and women who've given blood, sweat, and tears, who've worked hard to give an outstanding, good quality product, they need to be respected for what they've given, what they continue to give. And at the same time, business has got to make a profit. Business can't be in business to go out of business. That's not what they're there for. They can't contribute to the well-being of our country. They can't make contributions to scholarships and to our cultural arts unless they're profitable. We've got to find a way working together to make sure collectively that we all can coexist.
What are your dreams going forward?
My dream is to have our region work together, and I believe we will. I think with new leadership and with the kinds of working relationship that can be done, it can happen. My dream is for a great state, which means that Jennifer Granholm is going to be our governor again. And I believe that working together, this issue of race, we can manage it.
Dennis, thanks very much for sharing your amazing story. Thanks for the tireless, unending work that you've done as mayor and after. Our guest next Sunday arguably is the greatest university president of the last century, Father Ted Hesburgh of Notre Dame. Until then, I'm Jack Crisula. Thanks for listening. Anything is possible, and make it a great week. Spoken.